Welcome to the History Today podcast for July 2015. In this episode, a fascinating look at a language that is the source for many spoken today, and a report on an exhibition about one of the first photographers to document India and Burma. Firstly, a quick mention that the August issue of History Today is out now. In our August issue, we've got The Fall of Robespierre, Richard III and the Medieval Cult of Sainthood, and a look at what the early modern city really smelled like. You can buy the issue via our website or download it with the History Today app. Now on with the show. Harry Ritchie is the author of English for the Natives, Discover the Grammar You Don't Know You Know. In our August issue, he's written about Proto-Indo-European, a little-known language that, remarkably, is the source of the languages spoken today by more than 3 billion people, from the Hebrides to the Himalayas. Early this week, our editor, Paul Lay, caught up with Harry by phone.
Can you tell us something about the particular time period we're talking about, Harry?
Yeah, well, I think I can now, but I mean, maybe 6 years ago or so, it would have been a bit more difficult. It's only very recently that this tribe has been identified in time. We've known about them for 200 years, but just identifying when they existed and where has always been very problematic. But recently, I think the new research points to 3,500 BC and a homeland in near Volgograd, just north of the Caspian Sea on the edge of the steppes. This is a tribe that lived in that specific place and at that specific time in the 4th century BC at the part of the Bronze Age, and that one tribe bequeathed their language. We all, from Iceland to Nepal, we all speak descendants of that one language.
And you talk about this being a language that's a theory that's a couple of centuries old. How did that derive from it? Basically, people discovering relationships between Sanskrit and ancient Greek, I understand.
Yes, it started, people started to notice at the end of the 18th century how the similarities between, not just between Latin and Greek individual words and the way that they worked, but also, very interestingly, they thought, and absolutely rightly, Sanskrit. Sanskrit was very like ancient Greek, but even more so, even more complicated in its grammatical system. And the people were really impressed by this, and really impressed by the fact that a non-European language could bear such an uncanny resemblance to, you know, the most revered European language, which is Greek. So this people, the 19th century, it was a great achievement, really, of the 19th century linguists, called themselves philologists, to trace the history of all Europe's words, and a massive undertaking. You know, you just look at all the vocabularies of, I don't know, let's say 50 languages, and trace the similarities between them. And then because they then discovered that there are rules governing language change, all languages change, but in particular predictable ways, you know, they don't make sudden leaps from one sort of thing to another. They go step by step, and at a particular rate. So you say that it's a theory, but it's actually it's as near fact as you can get without actually having them telling us all about it. But the evidence is absolutely compelling. What the 19th century linguists have discovered was that every language in Europe, with the exception of Basque, every language in Europe, every language in northern India, Nepal, Afghanistan, Iran, we all come from one language, because they could trace the descendants. And then even if there were no record of the descendant languages, the further you go back in time, they could infer what the ancestral languages were because of the shared features that they would have in the daughter languages that they've bequeathed. You can infer what was going on in the past, and you can keep going beyond the invention of writing in the 3rd century third millennium BC, and then go back even farther. So some people have tried to go back as far as, well, recently 13,000 years to discover what kind of languages were being spoken then. Really, that's very controversial. What isn't controversial is the language of Proto-Indo-European, which is the ghastly term they've given this one ancestral language, which somehow had the linguistic takeover of the known world.
And you use the example of the word for a male parent, which of course in English is father, and use the Dutch examples of vader, in German vater, Scandinavian language far. And this goes right even to extinct languages such as Turkarian, whereas Parcher related to Pater in Latin.
And Turkarian was a language spoken on the edge of the Chinese border. I mean, that was a branch that went east. So their reach was extraordinary, and it was one tribe. And don't forget, they weren't just kind of going into empty homelands and then speaking their own language. There were hundreds, thousands of languages being spoken all over Europe and indeed the northwestern China at that time. But somehow they were all wiped out by this one language.
So why were they so successful, these early globalizers?
Well, the easiest theory would be that they were the people who introduced farming. And that was a favourite theory for a while, because only that would explain the absolute takeover. You know, they've got this new technology, they come in, they introduce it, they just replace the hunter-gatherers that were there before. But that doesn't fit. That farming happened in Europe 7,000 BC. This happened much later. So the obvious thing then would be military invasion. Maybe they just took over the whole world, you know. But that seems unlikely. There were too few of them. But what they did have, they had two secret weapons, which they were a fascinating tribe, but they had two, not just one, but two items of new technology. And I think those helped them explained them. They had the tamed horse, tamed the horse in the steppe. And they used horses actually as herds for meat, as well as riding them. And then they had the wheel, which had come from Ur in Mesopotamia, invented fairly recently, and they got the wheel. So they were pulling wagons, horse-drawn wagons, and that was their secret weapon, because they were nomads, and very, very successful nomads. So it was a different sort of invasion. They took over all of Europe and in northern India, as their kind of pasture land.
And you're also talking about, the period we're talking about here is the Bronze Age, which is a period of very dry conditions. So settled farmers would have quite a problem.
A Europe at the time which had been really prosperous, and a civilizations which had really thrived, agrarian civilizations. Especially around around the Danube and places, the farming had really worked tremendously well in Europe. And then there was climate change, a sudden dryness. And I think it turned very cold as well, cold and dry, and devastated the crops. But it was great for grazing for the Proto-Indo-Europeans. They had huge herds, the largest herd the world had ever seen at that point. 500,000 animals being shepherded by horsemen.
And so these people were wealthy, they were well fed when others weren't, they had wheels, as you point out. And so there becomes an element of this language having a prestige because of these associations, in much the way, say, English does due to its connections with the United States, for example, and popular culture. There's an element of that to it.
English is the modern-day equivalent. English hasn't wiped out languages as such, but it is so powerful that it's, in effect, English is going to be one of the very few languages left by the end of this century. At the moment, there's 7,000 languages in the world. By the end of this century, there'll be 500. So that's a dramatic process of extinction. It's that kind of process taken on, which happened, in, I think, at that time in Europe, that one language just simply took over because it had such prestige. And I think one of the things that really helped that prestige, we've got echoes of still, that was their story. What they a crucial part of their culture was that they could invite people into it, so people weren't excluded; they were invited in if they bought into the whole culture. And they had a fantastically glamorous kind of the equivalent of Hollywood. Their propaganda thing, their entertainment, was them to hold huge feasts at which there would be enormously long praise poems recited in honor of the chief or the tribe, and that would confer an immense glamour on this language. So here, these people were really, really rich, really doing very well. Everyone else starving, and they come along with their parties and their poems and singing and drink. They had mead.
And the leader of this tribe, who was probably a warrior priest, was called a rex, which again is linked to the Latin rex, and
yeah,
we see the linguistic connection
there.
This
is where you can actually have some. It's quite thrilling, I think, to see known words in a brought a language spoken in 3,500 BC, so that we know that their word for a leader was rex, which obviously is Latin rex.
And we know their number system too, or at least we know
how
they count from 1 to 10.
I think I'm not very good in my Proto-Indo-European pronunciation. I really have to be fairly apologetic about it. But it goes something like, here's 1 to 10. Oinos, duo, treyes, quatuores, penque, twex, septum, octu, nun, decum. Pretty familiar. Oino, duo, treye. Amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. It's a fascinating story, Harry. And it's available, the story of the Proto-Indo-Europeans, in the August edition of History Today. So thank you very much, Harry. Thank you.
Thank you.
Harry Ritchie and Paul Lay there. You can read more about Proto-Indo-European in the August issue of History Today. Now we head over to Burma and India, via the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. Here's Rhys Griffiths to explain more.
In the 1850s, Captain Elias Tripe was among the earliest photographers to document India and Burma, first in an amateur capacity as a British soldier working for the East India Company, and later as official photographer to the region. More than 60 of Tripe's prints, produced between 1852 and 1860, are currently on display at the Victoria and Albert Museum in what is the photographer's first major British exhibition. I met the exhibition's curator, Roger Taylor, to discuss Tripe's life, his involvement on the mission to Burma, and his impact on 19th century photography.
Captain Linnaeus Tripe was born in Devonport, in England, one of many sons, and like all younger sons in the British upper classes and middle classes, you couldn't inherit, you had to go off and make good, and he got sent off to the Indian Army. And so at a very young age, I think it was the age of 18, he sails and leaves England and becomes a cadet in the Army of the East India Company in Madras. And while he was there for the first 10 years, he was away from everything. No sense of photography, didn't know what photography was. And then when he comes back in 1851, you had to serve 10 years before you could come back home on leave. Comes back on leave and arrives in April 1851, literally just before the Great Exhibition. He arrives at the Great Exhibition and bingo, you know, he goes out and photography is part of this whole, this is what's coming on. And he's around and there's a formation of the Photographic Society. And this is the first formal Photographic Society in Britain, and it was set up in 1853. He clearly heard about it, knew about it, and he was one of the founder members. He was, I think, number 3 on the list. He was there, you know, with everybody and at its foundation formation. And in December of 1854, he goes down to Mysore and starts documenting one of the oldest and most ruinous temple sites in a place called Bellore. Mm-hmm. And he sets off down there, and he makes a series of photographs and he surveys the site. His approach to the site is that of a surveyor. He comes up with a ton of photographs. That is entirely self-initiated, so there was no reason for it, no outcome, he just wanted to do it. And it comes to the attention of a man called Lord Harris. Mm-hmm. And Lord Harris thinks he's a wonderful, sends word up to Lord Dalhousie, who was the Governor General. And as a result of that, he then gets commissioned to join the mission to Burma. Mm-hmm. He prints the Burma series, and as a result of that, he then gets appointed to become the official photographer to South India. The mission to Burma, we had had a dispute and gained territory with the Burmese in Lower Burma and had occupied Rangoon and taken over the lower reaches of Burma. And the British administration in India wanted to reach a settlement with the king, Mindon Min, who had succeeded his brother. And diplomatic negotiations began throughout 53 and then 54 with exchange of gifts and exchange of a diplomatic party down to Calcutta. And that in turn led to the mission, a diplomatic mission being sent up the river to Mirapur to see the king, to try and get a proper treaty. Dalhousie knew from the outset he wasn't going to get it. But that actually didn't matter. What mattered was sending this in and establishing good relationships with his king. It's hard to imagine what a diplomatic mission is in the 19th century. I mean, there were nearly 500 of them on four boats. Yeah, I mean, it's a big undertaking. But at the core of it, we have a group of men who are all experts in their field, geology, hydrology, mining, etc. And they all go up and they're all working to gather information. So at every stage on the river, someone measuring the bottom of the river, working out how deep it is, where the rapids are, where the shoals are, every man. They go on shore and look at the fields which were producing oil. They found out where the oil fields were. They found out where the coal seams were. They found out where the roads were. They found out all this information. And they would gather all of this. They go to Pagan Mayo and they start to survey the site. The major temples there, they measure and draw as accurately as they can and try and photograph them. So you have these photographic records and you have these drawn plans and elevations done by the surveyors. If you're ruling, you're the ruling authority, you have a responsibility to try and understand it. And you map it, you survey it. I mean, there was a trigonometric survey of India. Can you imagine the task of doing that? Starting in the south of India and ending up in the Himalayas. I mean, it's just this mind-blowing task. You then had to know where everything lay. You had to know the numbers. You had to know as much data as you could gather. So on one level, it's about data and information gathering. At another level, it's actually about making a document of fact. So that if we have these temples at Halabi that are in a ruinous state, this is a very powerful argument for their preservation. In essence, it was about documenting things before they disappear. Recording musical instruments and the way of life, the architecture, the religious buildings, etc., etc. So he's about this concept of a photographic survey. It's very early on in his mind. The photographs that he made in Burma are for private consumption, internal consumption. The V&A started collecting trout photographs, but essentially they were hidden. Very few of them were exhibited publicly, except in India. Very few of them have entered into the kind of public consciousness, for want of a better word, of India. And I think it's very sad. That's part of the problem. He's remained largely unknown. There were others at work, but nobody at that scale, and nobody with that output, and nobody with that kind of unique vision of visual discipline plus artistic sensibility, and nobody who produced such comprehensive bodies of work like the Burma series and like all the volumes for the Madras series. Nobody did that. So his output in that sense was different to everybody else, and he has a very important place in our understanding of early photographic history, and particularly early photographic history in India.
Our thanks to Roger Taylor. The exhibition is at the V&A until October 2015. That's all for this episode. The August issue of History Today is out now, while this podcast will return next month. Thanks for listening.